From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
As a result of the president's failure to act, Secretary Chertoff's failure to act, and the failure of Congress to act, it appears we are about to see a new underclass of Katrina homeless in America.
The House Select Committee on Hurricane Katrina releases its report. Though most Democrats boycotted the committee, we'll speak with one who didn't, Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney. And are New Orleans evacuees being denied the right to vote? In Haiti, René Préval is declared the winner. And a UN report calls for the closing of Guantanamo. We'll talk with Chaplain James Yee.
As an insider who spent 10 months in Guantanamo in 2002 and most of 2003, I can say without a doubt that many of the things pointed out in this report are in fact true.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Haiti, René Préval has been declared the country's new president, winning last week's election, the first since the ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide 2 years ago. Préval is a former ally of Aristide and received much of his support from Aristide supporters, including the prominent priest Gerard Jean-Just. Like Aristide, Préval is seen as a champion of the poor. He's pledged to create jobs, improve education, and battle social inequities in Haiti. Préval's victory was announced early this morning after agreement was reached between the interim government and the Electoral Council. It had looked like Haiti was headed for a political crisis. With nearly all the votes counted, Préval had fallen just shy of the 50% margin needed to avoid a runoff. However, Préval had called for an investigation into possible election fraud after it was discovered that 85,000 blank ballots were cast. Up to thousands of burnt ballots were also discovered in a state garbage dump. Under the agreement, some of the blank ballots were subtracted from the total number of votes counted, giving Préval the majority he needed. In other news, United Nations investigators have called on the Bush administration to immediately close the Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba. The UN report urges the U.S. government to, quote, refrain from any practice amounting to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. The report goes on to state, quote, in the case of the Guantanamo Bay detainees, the U.S. executive operates as judge, as prosecutor, and as defense counsel. This constitutes serious violations of various guarantees of the right to a fair trial before an independent tribunal, unquote. About 500 men are being held at Guantanamo. Charges have never been filed against most of them. State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick dismissed the report. He said the UN information is, quote, based on hearsay. In Iraq, the publication of new photographs showing Iraqi detainees being tortured inside the U.S.-run Abu Ghraib prison is being met by outrage. The Australian broadcaster SBS first aired the photographs Wednesday. Many of the images have been reprinted in Iraqi newspapers and aired on television. One Iraqi citizen, Adalwad, says the photos prove the United States was acting in violation of international law.
We feel sorry about the photos we saw yesterday. We saw humiliation to the Iraqis, and we saw that there's no respect to the dignity of the Iraqi people in this country. The country where we were masters, we are now slaves, and the masters come from abroad. In addition to the Abu Ghraib abuse photos, we saw Iraqis being beaten in Basra by the British forces. This is a violation of international laws, which they used as a pretext to invade Iraq. We feel sorry that such acts are being repeated on a daily basis at the Iraqi streets. There is unjustified killings by the U.S. force. The public opinion is misled, and regrettably enough, the Iraqi prisoner was treated in a barbaric and savage way at the hands of the American forces.
One photograph showed a man lying dead in the dirt with blood coming out of his head. Another showed a naked man hanging from a bed by his knees. Another prisoner is shown covered in feces. Naked men are also shown in sexually humiliating positions. Prisoners are photographed wearing hoods. Men were also photographed showing what appears to be burn and torture marks. And the outcry over the photos may only intensify. Earlier today, Salon.com published even more photographs from Abu Ghraib. The online publication obtained files and other electronic documents from an internal army investigation. The material includes more than 1,000 photographs, videos, and supporting documents. According to Salon.com, some of the documents refer to CIA personnel as interrogators of prisoners at Abu Ghraib. To date, no CIA officers have been prosecuted for any crimes that occurred within the prison, despite the death of at least one Iraqi during a CIA interrogation there. On Wednesday, the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, and other groups called for a truly independent investigation to look at all levels of the military chain of command, as well as involvement from other government agencies like the CIA and private military contractors who've been implicated in the abuses. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is criticizing publication of the new photographs. Pentagon spokesperson Brian Whitman said the release of the images, quote, could only further inflame and possibly incite unnecessary violence in the world and would endanger our military men and women that are serving in places around the world, he said. State Department legal advisor John Bellinger also criticized the release of the photos.
These additional photographs that are now out are disgusting and shows once again just the reprehensible conduct that was going on in Abu Ghraib. It's unfortunate, though, that the photographs are continuing to come out because I think it simply fans the flames at a time that sentiments on these issues are raw around the world.
Meanwhile, Mike Carey, the executive producer of the Australian program Dateline, defended the broadcast of the images.
This was new examples of abuse, criminal abuse potentially, lots of corpses with no explanation why they were there. We thought we had a responsibility to broadcast those to show the real horror of what happened in Abu Ghraib. We actually did not broadcast some of the photographs because we thought they were too extreme. We've got lots more photographs on the DVDs we obtained. Some of them are particularly sick. Some show sex acts between the guards at Abu Ghraib, apparently dressed in fatigues, probably occurring in Abu Ghraib. Lots of stuff like that we could have shown, we didn't.
Mike Carey of the Australian news program Dateline. In other Iraq news, the human rights group Global Exchange and anti-war group Code Pink are criticizing the Bush administration for refusing to allow two Iraqi women into the United States. The women have been scheduled to take part in a speaking tour and to participate in the March 8th Women Say No to War march in Washington. Both women were widows whose husbands and children were killed by U.S. troops. According to the groups, the State Department rejected the visas because the women didn't have enough family in Iraq to prove they'll return to the country and not emigrate to the United States. Organizer Medea Benjamin said, quote, "It's appalling that the U.S. military killed these women's families, and then the U.S. government rejects their visas on the grounds that they have no family to return to in Iraq." And in domestic news, Vice President Dick Cheney has spoken publicly for the first time about how he accidentally shot his hunting partner Saturday. The prominent Texan attorney, Harry Whittington, remains hospitalized. Cheney shot the 78-year-old man in the face, neck, shoulder, and chest. Earlier this week, Whittington suffered a minor heart attack. Cheney has come under increasing criticism for withholding information from the press about the shooting for nearly a day and then waiting three more days to make a public statement. On Wednesday, the vice president spoke with Fox News' Britt Hume.
Ultimately, I'm the guy who pulled the trigger that fired the round that hit Harry. And you can talk about all of the other conditions that existed at the time, but that's the bottom line. And it was not Harry's fault. You can't blame anybody else. I'm the guy who pulled the trigger and shot my friend.
During the interview, Cheney also defended his decision not to report the shooting to the national press. The story leaked out Sunday after first appearing on the website of the Corpus Christi Caller-Times, a paper in South Texas. Questions have also been raised about whether alcohol played a factor in the shooting. Up until Wednesday, the owner of the ranch, Catherine Armstrong, had said no one was drinking alcohol before the shooting and that Dr. Pepper had been served at lunch. However, Cheney admitted yesterday he had a beer during lunch several hours before the shooting, but the vice president denied that anyone was under the influence of alcohol at the time of the shooting. The shooting safety rules of the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department warn, quote, "Don't drink alcohol or take drugs before or while handling firearms or bow and arrows." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House Select Committee, examining the federal response to Hurricane Katrina, yesterday released a 600-page report harshly criticizing the federal government's response to the disaster. The report is entitled A Failure of Initiative. It blames the government for, quote, an abdication of the most solemn obligation to provide for the common welfare. The report assigned blame to all levels of government for the failed response to the storm. But Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff and President Bush's staff drew the heaviest fire. The report says Chertoff should have moved 2 days before Katrina hit, when the National Weather Service issued dire warnings about the storm, and that the Homeland Security Department should have done more to help the Gulf Coast. It states, quote, the failure of complete evacuation resulted in hundreds of deaths and severe suffering for thousands. The report goes on to say, quote, if 9/11 was a failure of imagination, Katrina was a failure of initiative. The committee that prepared the report was comprised of 11 Republicans. Democrats refused to be involved officially because they feared a whitewash. However, two Democratic Louisiana Congress members, William Jefferson and Charlie Manson, participated informally in the committee's activities. Georgia Democratic Congress member Cynthia McKinney also participated. All three released their own supplementary reports and said the official House committee report did not go far enough, especially in addressing the needs of thousands of hurricane victims who remain homeless. They also called for Michael Chertoff to resign. We turn now to Congressmember Cynthia McKinney of Georgia, who did participate in the Select Committee, though most Democrats did not. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Congressmember McKinney.
Good morning, Amy, and it's so good to talk to you again. I want to say thank you for calling me and thinking about me.
Well, we watched you yesterday as the Select Committee on the Response to Hurricane Katrina released their report. Can you talk about the results, also why you participated, and your response to the report?
Thank you very much. Let me just say that I am particularly pleased to read in the Hill newspaper, which is a newspaper up here on Capitol Hill, that some Democrats are now having second thoughts about the work of the Katrina panel, which they had previously called a sham panel. Now, I'm hard-pressed to explain to the Katrina survivors and to the communities that have welcomed them why the Democrats would boycott a panel and judge its work product before it actually produced any work, especially while holding the 911 commission up as an example of the type of panel that should explore Katrina. Everyone knows, in actuality, that the 911 commission was what was actually a sham. And yesterday, in public open session, the House Armed Services Committee heard testimony about Able Danger. And from three witnesses who testified, they said that if they had been allowed to do their work, that that work could possibly have prevented 911. And this is the same team of people whose work was called historically insignificant by Dr. Zelikow, and whose work Louis Free said that if he had had that information, could also quite possibly have saved this country the trauma of 911. Now, Dr. Zelikow made a judgment to bury the work of the Able Danger team. And so for the Democrats to hold the 911 commission up as a model is quite honestly ludicrous. What the American people know after the 911 commission is that they can't trust that particular independent commission to tell them the truth. But as a result of the work that the Katrina panel did, we at least know more now than we knew before. And what do we know? What's on the congressional record now as a result of the work of the Katrina panel is that President Bush was on vacation at the Texas ranch. Vice President Cheney was fly fishing in Wyoming. Condoleezza Rice was in New York City, where she took in a play, went shopping, and played tennis with Monica Seles. Donald Rumsfeld was at a San Diego Padres game. And Michael Chertoff, the man whose job it was to manage our country's resources and organize the response to this horrific hurricane, didn't even know he was in charge and decided to stay home. Yes, I call for his resignation, too.
The Republicans on the Select Committee did not call for his resignation. Is that right?
The Republicans pointed a fair amount of blame at Secretary Chertoff because it was clear in many of the proceedings, everything went back to the Department of Homeland Security. And it's not sufficient to say, well, I extended authority to the FEMA chief. There is some point at which the secretary has to come out of his house and decide that saving the Gulf states is important. And quite frankly, I have to say to you that the mental gymnastics that the American people are watching now with Secretary Chertoff trying to defend the indefensible is fatiguing. And so what needs to really happen so that the administration can get a clean break on this and start all over again and do justice to the people of the Gulf states who are still suffering and facing the onslaught of another hurricane season is for him to leave and let the administration start all over again.
So what did the Democrats do now? They didn't participate, except for the three of you, in this select committee response to Hurricane Katrina. What happens now?
Well, that's a question that's better posed to Nancy Pelosi, who made the decision that Democrats shouldn't participate. But one of the things that we must do is there is an omnibus piece of legislation that the congressional members of the Congressional Black Caucus have introduced. That legislation, the Democrats ought to push for hearings in every one of the 10 or 11 committees that the legislation has been assigned to, push for hearings in each one of those committees. The debacle that we've seen with FEMA putting people out of hotel rooms needs to be stopped, and we need an important voice. We need the Democratic voice from the leadership on this issue to make the people whole again. FEMA is saying that it will take them 2 years to produce maps that will tell people where they can and cannot live in the affected regions. That means that the 300,000 people who are no longer in New Orleans can't come back until FEMA tells them where they can rebuild. This means that people are going to be in limbo for the 2 years. Democrats need to make sure, and I would commend, it's not that Democrats have done nothing, because there are some Democrats who have been very active and very vocal on this issue and have pushed legislation. And I want to commend those, particularly in the area of housing. Congressman Barney Frank, Congresswoman Maxine Waters have worked hard and actually went to the Gulf area in a hearing with Congressman Ney from House Administration, formerly of House Administration. So it's not that Democrats aren't doing anything, but this is an opportunity to get important information on the congressional record and to make Congress move. Even Governor Haley Barbour came before the Katrina panel and begged Congress to move. And that's what all of the Democrats ought to be doing, and pushing and pushing and pushing to pass legislation and to get dollars into the hands of people so that they can make their lives whole again.
I have just a quick question that might sound off topic, though perhaps it's right on topic, and that is, you are a longtime congressmember from Georgia. You lost your seat for a term and then came back. Where do you stand in terms of seniority since you've returned?
Thank you for asking that question. There were three former members who were in my returning class sworn in 1995. There was Dan Lundgren, who from California, who had been out for 16 years. When he came back, the Republican leadership gave him back his seniority as if he had not missed one day. There was Bob Inglis from South Carolina, who had been out for 2 years. When he came back, the Republican leadership gave him his seniority as if he had not missed one day. The Democratic leadership, Nancy Pelosi, refused to give me back my seniority, even though I asked for it, and so I returned as a returning freshman.
Congressmember McKinney, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a Democratic congressmember from Georgia. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Back in a minute.
Way down in New Orleans, I saw the rising sun. I've been the run of a many poor boys, and be your God for one. Way down in New Orleans, I saw the rising sun. I've been the run of a many poor boys, and me your God for one. I'm gonna tell my baby sister, please don't do like I have done. Please shine that old house in New Orleans, take all the rising sun. I'm gonna tell my baby sister, please don't do like I have done. Please shine that old house in New Orleans, they call the rising sun. Go tell her now.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That's Leadbelly, New Orleans. I'm Amy Goodman. Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff testified Wednesday before the Bipartisan Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs in his role in the bungled response to Hurricane Katrina. Chertoff has been on the defensive since a Government Accountability Office report was filed February 1st. That report and the House report Wednesday sharply criticized his agency's response to the disaster. After Chertoff's opening statement, the hearing was interrupted by Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who was in the audience. He's CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus.
Mothers and children are being thrown in the street.
Sir, this is not a public hearing today.
This is not American. They're being evicted. But they're being thrown in the ground. It's hard.
I understand that, and the committee is working on that issue. We've been to the area twice. I invite you to sit quietly and allow us to proceed with the hearing. Thank you.
Security ushered him out of the room in Wednesday's hearing. Michael Chertoff, though, stayed. He admitted to several failures, including that he and his department had moved far too slowly in obtaining buses to evacuate the thousands of refugees stranded in the New Orleans Superdome and Convention Center. Chertoff also admitted to wrongly entrusting former FEMA head Michael Brown with managing the response to the disaster. In testimony last week, Brown admitted to willfully working to circumvent Chertoff's authority during and after the hurricane. Chertoff blamed his department's failures on lapses in management and communication, also said the Department of Homeland Security's excessive focus on the threat of terrorism had hindered its ability to prepare for a natural disaster. Chertoff also spoke yesterday about the ongoing hotel evictions of evacuees.
Because we all bear a measure of responsibility in a natural disaster of this proportions. It's just in the executive branch, it's the Congress. And we want to be supportive because we have learned from bitter experience in this the element of human suffering. You heard the gentleman behind you get up and speak out about the plight of so many individuals today. I know they're foremost in your mind. What active steps are you taking today to try and alleviate the suffering that's taking place every hour we sit here?
Here is the program we have in place. In order to transition people from having the government directly pay for hotels, which are very expensive, to having people receiving assistance that they can use to find places to live or receiving trailers. We put into a process, a program to first of all validate the appropriateness of everybody in the hotel, see who is in fact entitled to be there and who isn't, get them their money, and then give them a couple of weeks from the time they get their money to find some place to live. We've done a lot of intensive work sending teams in to meet with people in hotels to give them housing solutions. If they have to wait for trailers or if they have to wait for apartments, they will have individual assistance that they can use to pay for places to live until that happens. I know the hotels are a little impatient, and with tourism coming up, some of them want to push people out. We've tried to be very hard, to be sensitive to helping people find housing, but ultimately move us away from what is a very expensive program of having large numbers of people in hotels.
Michael Chertoff was being questioned by the Virginia Republican Senator Warner at Wednesday's hearing in front of the Senate Committee for Homeland Security. We're now joined on the telephone by Bill Quigley, an attorney based in New Orleans who's been representing a number of evacuees who are staying in hotels and also have been evicted. He's a law professor at Loyola University. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here. Thank
it's
you.
It's good to have you with us. Actually, before we have you respond to what we just played of Michael Chertoff and his testimony, I wanted to ask you a quick question on another issue, and that is Haiti. We have just gotten word that the decision has been made to declare René Préval the victor in last week's presidential elections in Haiti. Bill, you have been longtime active on Haiti, representing Father Jean Juste while he's been imprisoned for many months there. Your response?
Well, I think that's wonderful. It's actually something I didn't hear yet, so that's very exciting. I know that is a reflection of the will of the people of Haiti, and the will of the people of Haiti have been frustrated so frequently and by the small elites in Haiti, backed by the United States, France, and Canada, that this is a wonderful victory that people, I'm sure, are going to celebrate, hopefully for a very long time. But as your listeners well know, any victory for the people in Haiti is something that has to be guarded, and they have to be very vigilant. So I think that's wonderful news, and I think that reflects the strength and the determination of the people in Haiti and also their allies across the world who are fighting for human rights and democracy.
Well, now we're going to go back to the issue at hand, and that is Katrina. We are joined by Bill Quigley as well as by Tracy Washington, who've been working side by side on the issue of the evacuees. First, Bill Quigley, your response to Michael Chertoff at the hearing.
I think that's just, too little too late. Clearly, what's happened in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast is a massive failure, but the importance is not only that it's a massive failure of the poor and the disabled and the elderly and people of color at the time of the response to the hurricane, which everybody saw, but the same people are being left behind now in the reconstruction. And also, there's a big missing point in what the House did. I would encourage people to look to Representative Cynthia McKinney's analysis of it. And that is, this didn't just happen. There was a reason that one quarter of the people in New Orleans didn't have cars. Yes.
Tracy Washington, your response. You have been spending many months going from hotel to try to stop people from being evacuated. Michael Chertoff says they're doing all they can to take care of people, yet the big eviction notices going out this past week. What are you doing?
Well, and you may be hearing some feedback. It seems they may have another program on my side, but I think it's just disingenuous. There can be no doubt after looking at the Arkansas trailers on the ground and all the other mismanagement and waste by FEMA that they've not done everything that they can do to help the evacuees in the Gulf Coast area. We have people here who are suffering, who do not have housing, who are living in their cars right now, and the statement by Chertoff that they have, and that mission that they have mismanaged many of the resources, tells me that they've left New Orleanians who have suffered gravely through this tragedy, they've left us out high and dry.
We are also joined on the phone by Deborah Bell, a Katrina evacuee living in Houston. She'll have to be out of her hotel by March 1st. We've heard a lot about trailers that were bought but are not being used. What is happening with you, Deborah?
Hi. I first applied for a trailer in October of last year. I was told that the process would be expedited because for medical reasons, I needed to be in the trailer in order to be close to Ochsner Hospital. I had a double lung transplant. But months went by, months and months went by. I kept being told that I was going to get the trailer. But in the meantime, I was having to take that six-hour drive from Houston to New Orleans for the specialized care that I've needed. Just last week, we got the trailer, but we have no electricity for the trailer. FEMA didn't bring the pole out. Entergy, which is the electric company for New Orleans, they haven't turned our service on. And so my husband is going to be evicted from their hotel on March the 1st because we have a trailer there that we can't use at this time. And so that's been our frustration.
And you hear that story over and over and over.
Tracy Washington.
It's probably one of the biggest tragedies out here that so many people have been promised so much by FEMA, be it adequate rental assistance or trailers. And when FEMA doesn't deliver, the evacuees are penalized.
So here you have a New Orleans evacuee, Deborah, who had a double lung transplant, has finally gotten a trailer, which is more than a lot of people, but there's no electricity for her and her family to function in it. So, Tracy Washington, what about specifically these trailers? How many are there? How many haven't been delivered? And what is your response to Michael Chertoff saying they're doing all they can?
Well, they're not doing all they can. I mean, that's just not true. You know, anytime you can look on any of the news stations and see 10,000, 15,000 trailers and mobile homes parked in Arkansas, when you see trailer parks basically here in New Orleans that where folks cannot get into the trailers. We've had demonstrations by trailer parks that are empty here in New Orleans and in the New Orleans area. In an outlying parish, St. Bernard Parish, they did a beautiful act of civil disobedience, and the parish council went and moved trailers off the lot so that their people could have housing. You know, and a bigger tragedy, and not to take away from just the individuals who are going to be without homes, but on March 1, our police officers and firefighters who are waiting for trailers, who are living temporarily on a ship, will also be homeless. We will have homeless police officers and firefighters. And it's just the most absurd thing for Mr. Chertoff to say, look, we're doing everything we can. You're not.
Bill Quigley, at the height of the levees breaking and right after the hurricane, we were speaking to you each day from the hospital where you were with your wife, who was a nurse. And I'd like to ask you about the state of the hospitals right now in New Orleans. We just heard that Tulane has opened up a part of the hospital. But we also heard about questions of doctors deciding to help patients die because they just didn't want them to go through the suffering. Your response?
Well, very few of the hospitals in the metropolitan area are open. I think 7 of the 22 hospitals are open right now. I'll give you an example. We had, it just shows you some of the interrelatedness of the problem is one of the people in my office night before last at 8 o'clock at night took a man up to Baton Rouge, which is 85 miles away, to set a broken arm. His arm had been broken for 11 days. It's an undocumented worker who fell off of a roof. The contractor left him, and there was no facility in the New Orleans area that could set his arm for somebody who was an uninsured patient. So he had to be brought. He waited 10-plus days. His arm was purple and swollen. So the health care provisions here are very patchwork. We do have some people who go to the emergency room with heart problems and heart attacks and that stuff. They're looking at waits of 8 to 12 hours in the emergency room. The medical system has melted down, along with many of our other institutions, and the criminal investigation into the euthanasia that has been alleged at various hospitals is continuing and sounds like it should be coming to a head here before long, and I think we're going to find out that doctors did, in fact, perform what they would term mercy killings, but the state may term something else, for people who had been without electricity, without water, without food, and didn't look like they could be evacuated. And after days and days of inaction by the federal, state, and local government, that they thought in their mind that it was better to put these folks out of their misery than try to bring them down places without electricity and that sort of stuff. So it's a very, very tragic situation. And the one last thing I would like to say is that people here are not advocating for some sort of special luxurious treatment. These trailers that people are getting in are tiny, tiny trailers. They are, set up in front of destroyed houses. People are all they really want is a chance to be able to get on their feet, to hold on to a job. FEMA has said for people who are working in New Orleans but were in these hotels, we'll take you to North Louisiana or Tennessee where you can get a cheap apartment, but they have to give up their job. They have to pull their kids out of the fourth school that they've been in already to do this stuff. FEMA is either doesn't care, and I mean FEMA, when we say FEMA, we shouldn't just say FEMA. FEMA is George Bush. This is an executive branch of the government that is doing exactly what the president says. George Bush either doesn't care what happens to the poor people in this area of the country, or he is so incompetent that they can't do any better. It's not a question we're doing the best we can. They're doing as good as they are doing, which is terrible, and that's either a conscious choice that they don't care, or it's a decision that the thing is so messed up that there's nothing more that they can do.
We're going to have to leave it there, and I want to thank you all for being with us. Bill Quigley, a professor of law at Loyola in New Orleans, also Tracy Washington, attorney on the line with us from New Orleans, and we've been joined by Deborah Bell, who is an evacuee from New Orleans. As we turn now to another issue related to the situation in New Orleans. We now look at how Hurricane Katrina is affecting the political power of New Orleans residents. Local elections in New Orleans are set for April. Among other races, voters will cast ballots for mayor. The incumbent mayor is Ray Nagin. He's facing challenges from more than half a dozen contestants, but remains the only Black candidate in the race. Last week, the Advancement Project filed a federal lawsuit challenging election plans for New Orleans, alleging the plan puts too much emphasis on absentee voting and would keep African Americans out of office. According to the lawsuit, Louisiana's emergency election plan following Hurricane Katrina will disenfranchise thousands of displaced voters, the vast majority of whom are African American, therefore violating the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We're joined on the telephone right now by Penda Hare. She is the co-director of the Advancement Project. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you talk about the situation of voting in New Orleans?
Yes. What we're concerned about is that after hearing your prior guests, and Bill Quigley happens to be the co-counsel in this lawsuit also, but hearing them describe all of the disasters that New Orleans still faces, we are concerned that the election in April will be just one more disaster on top of everything else. And we are trying to prevent an election where only the predominantly white people who are currently living in New Orleans are allowed to vote, and the African-American population, which 80% of the African-American population of New Orleans was displaced and is now living in Houston or Dallas or Baton Rouge or other places around the country, will not have a fair opportunity to vote in that election. And our contention is that that would violate the Voting Rights Act, which requires that all the racial groups have an equal opportunity to vote and to elect the candidate of their choice.
Penda Hare, I wanted to play for you the comments of Alabama Congressmember Arthur Davis. He spoke recently at a Rainbow Push Wall Street Project event in New York City that was led by Reverend Jesse Jackson. This is Congressmember Davis.
It is impossible to have a conversation about New Orleans' future, about Louisiana's future, in my opinion, without making sure that political participation is ensured on part of people who've been displaced. That's why we've introduced a bill that would give displaced voters from Louisiana the same absentee ballot voter protection that our soldiers have right now. Right now, if you're a soldier and you're in Germany or you're in Japan or you're in Afghanistan or Iraq, you're allowed to vote absentee. Therefore, your political right back home is preserved. We have to do no less for the evacuees because of this reality. I remember before we left the press conference upstairs, there were a number of people who were there who were displaced citizens, and all of us hear the frustration every time we talk to them. Reverend Jackson, the main frustration I hear is no one is factoring our voices into the equation. All these people are sitting on the high side of the mountain talking about, do we rebuild? Should we rebuild? What do we rebuild? They're not asking the folk who live there. They're the one set of people excluded from the conversation. So that's the first step. We need to pass a bill giving that right to vote absentee ballot at the federal and state level to people who've been displaced.
So where does this federal legislation that's been introduced by Alabama Congress member Arthur Davis, Pendahare, fit into your lawsuit?
Well, the legislation is pending in Congress. It has not been acted on. There's no indication that it will be acted on soon, and therefore it will not be able to assist us in providing a fair election on April 22nd in New Orleans. So that's why we've had to go to federal court. The Louisiana legislature has had bills before it this week that would have set up what we call satellite voting centers around the country and also around the state of Louisiana, like this country did for the citizens of Iraq for their recent election. I don't know if your listeners know, but there were many voting locations for Iraqi citizens who live in the U.S. to vote in the U.S. in our major cities. They didn't have to fly back to Iraq. But what we're asking, you know, New Orleans residents who live in Atlanta or Houston or Los Angeles to do is to find transportation to go back to New Orleans on April 22nd and vote, or either master the complicated absentee ballot process that state law sets up. And neither of those is an equal opportunity with what the people who are living in New Orleans have, which is a convenient local polling place.
Who are the major obstacles to your demand that people be able to engage in absentee voting that is much more simplified?
Well, first let me say that the Secretary of State of Louisiana actually supports our proposal, and he has made that proposal to the legislature. So right now it's the members of the legislature who have refused to enact legislation that the Louisiana Black Caucus members have brought to them, that the Secretary of State has brought to them. Election experts know that this can be done, and in part we know it can be done because of how it was done for Iraq. And, you know, our democracy ought to at least be as convenient for our citizens as it, we've made it for citizens of other countries. So the lawsuit will go forward, assuming that the legislature doesn't pass any additional bills before it goes out of session tomorrow. The lawsuit will have a hearing next Thursday, February 23rd, and we will set forth our evidence, and we have strong hopes that the judge will enter an order soon thereafter that will make Louisiana officials put some fair procedures in place for the African-American voters and all voters who are scattered around the country.
Pendahare, I want to thank you for being with us, co-director of the Advancement Project. She is based in Washington, D.C. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, back in a minute. Democracy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations has called on the Bush administration to immediately close Guantanamo Bay prison camp in Cuba. In a report on conditions at the prison released today, the UN says the United States should try all prisoners or release them, quote, without further delay. The report, summarizing an investigation by five UN experts, urges the U.S. government to, quote, refrain from any practice amounting to torture or cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment, including the force feeding of hunger strikers through nasal tubes. The report goes on to state, quote, in the case of the Guantanamo Bay detainees, the U.S. executive operates as judge, as prosecutor, as defense counsel. This constitutes serious violations of various guarantees of the right to a fair trial before an independent tribunal, unquote. About 500 men are being held at Guantanamo. Charges have never been filed against most of them. The U.S. has rejected most of the allegations, saying the five investigators never actually visited Guantanamo. The U.S. invited the U.N. to the camp, but refused to grant the investigators the right to speak to prisoners in private. The U.N. said that private interviews were a totally non-negotiable precondition for conducting the visit and refused to send investigators. The report's findings were based on interviews with former detainees, public documents, media reports, lawyers, and a questionnaire filled out by the U.S. government. Last October, Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed attorney Julia Tarver, who represents 10 of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Three of her clients were taking part in a hunger strike to protest conditions at the prison. This is some of what Julia Tarver had to say.
What we've learned is that in some sort of ill-advised attempt to stop the hunger strike, the guards and the medical staff are using intervention, medical intervention, to actually inflict forms of torture on our clients. They claim that in order to preserve life at the base, they are inserting tubes into the client's noses and that go down into their stomachs, and they're able to be fed that way. But the problem is the clients have told us horrific stories repeatedly from different clients about how these same tubes are being forcibly inserted in by riot guards, how they're taken from one detainee and inserted into the next detainee with no sanitization, with the bile and the blood still on the tube from the previous detainee.
And all the while, these detainees are shackled most of the time, or what did you find?
What we've understood is that for various periods of time, they were definitely shackled, multiple shackles on their arms, on their legs, on their knees, on their heads, when they insisted over and over again that they would not resist because they knew resistance was futile. Some of that shackling stopped, but every time, we understand that the tubes were inserted, these riot teams were involved, six men holding one client down while someone inserts a tube up their nose and into their stomach.
Attorney Julia Tarver interviewed on Democracy Now! In October. We're joined now by someone who has spent time in Guantanamo Bay, both as a member of the U.S. Army and as a prisoner, Chaplain James Yee. He was one of the first Muslim chaplains commissioned by the U.S. Army. Yee was posted at Guantanamo, Cuba in 2002, but less than a year after serving there, he was accused of espionage by the military and faced charges so severe that he was threatened with the death penalty. The charges were eventually reduced, and 8 months later, dropped altogether. Chaplain Yee wrote a book about his experiences called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. He joins us again in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy
it's
Now.
Nice to be here again.
It's good to have you with us, Chaplain Yee. Can you respond to the UN report calling for the closing of Guantanamo?
Right. Yes, this UN report, this inquiry that we hear about this week, it's very significant because it's a confirmation that there were terrible abuses and degrading, cruel treatment down in Guantanamo. I can confirm that because I was there myself. And it also questions whether or not things have really changed or not, as the U.S. military and the U.S. government has said that things have changed. So it calls into question whether or not there have been changes made.
Can you talk about what you saw there and listening now to Julia Tarver on this issue of the force feeding of hunger strikers, sticking these tubes down the throats of men, and then when one man, the tube has been shoved down him, taking that same tube and sticking it down the person next to him?
Right. The aspect of force feeding was implemented when I was there, and I witnessed the actual process of this happening to detainees in the detention hospital. on several visits that I made to the hospital.
What did you see?
It's a very violent process in which the guards, they come and they hold the prisoner down, and they have to have guards hold the legs, the arms, which are already shackled, as well as the forehead back of the prisoner in order that this tube can be forced down the nose of the prisoner. After the tube and the nose itself are lubed with petroleum jelly or Vaseline, and as it goes in, of course, the prisoner lets out this shrieking scream because it's very painful.
Now, if they wanted to ensure that the prisoners got nutrition, couldn't they just give them intravenous?
Good question. I'm not an expert in the medical field, but perhaps that's one thing they could have done.
Of course, and the question is, should they be doing this at all if they are resisting, if they are in hunger strike? Did you raise concerns when you would see this at the prison hospital?
Of course, the concerns that I raised were the mental state and the mental deterioration that led these prisoners to go on these hunger strikes. They had gotten, the few that were permanent residents of the hospital who were being force-fed, had gotten to such a poor state in which they just refused to eat. They had no longer an appetite, and this is why they were being force-fed. So this is what actually initiated this process of force-feeding.
The UN investigators were not allowed at Guantanamo. Can you talk about what you saw going on there that the rest of the world has not been able to see?
Right. I think the main thing that sticks out is the state of these prisoners. The mental state and the conditions that these prisoners are under is drastic. And one of the things that indicated this when I was there is that the U.S. Army, or the mission down there, had a 17-man medical team of psychiatric nurses and doctors. And this is an indication that the mental illness that occurred down in Guantanamo of the prisoners was a serious problem.
I want to correct what I said. The investigators at the UN were allowed to go down, but they weren't allowed to interview the detainees alone. Why would that matter?
Because when you actually see how the prisoners are being treated in the detention operations and during interrogations, of course there are going to be serious concerns. And many of those concerns, of course, I raised based on reports that I received from military personnel down there as well as the prisoners themselves.
We're talking to Chaplain Yi. You were arrested leaving Guantanamo. Can you talk about what happened to you and why you think you went through the ordeal you did?
Yeah, coming back into the United States on what I thought would be a short two-week break, I was arrested at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. Customs officials, they stopped me, searched my bags, and claimed that I had suspicious documents. It was disturbing to learn that it was really the FBI who had requested that these customs officials identify specifically me, single me out, and search me. And then these documents were then handed over to intelligence officers who declared them to be classified. After which I was thrown in jail, which would ultimately be for 76 days in isolation. These heinous accusations and crimes were thrown against me that I had committed espionage or spying, aiding the enemy, and I was threatened with the death penalty. Ultimately, after 76 days, they would let me out and continue to try and prosecute me for mishandling classified documents, but then in the end, even those were dropped.
Why do you think they went after you?
I think this really happened mainly because one of my religious faith, being a Muslim American, was seen by some as meaning that I was also the enemy. Also, because I had an incredible amount of information about the abuses and about the mistreatment that was going on in Guantanamo, and as part of my role as a chaplain, reporting that on a routine basis to the operations center and to my chain of command, raised some concerns and they wanted to involuntarily take me out of that operation.
Can you talk about General Jeffrey Miller?
Excellent question here. The UN report actually also calls for the investigation and the holding of accountable people behind the abusive treatment of prisoners up to the highest levels. And I think this is a clear response to the fact that the official U.S. Southern Command investigation, which recommended a reprimand, disciplinary action for Major General Jeffrey Miller, the former commander of the Joint Task Force, who the U.S. Southern Command refused to administer. There was no discipline at senior levels of the military, and I think the calling in this UN report for that is a response to what's happening.
He's retired?
I've read that he submitted paperwork for retirement. I've read that in the newspaper.
Do you feel he singled you out?
Clearly, he took responsibility for my arrest, for throwing me in prison and bringing charges against me, even though initial media reports said that the decision to arrest me was made at the highest levels of the government.
Meaning?
I question whether or not a two-star general is the highest levels of the government, but I clearly hold him responsible for buying into these false reports that were made against me by inexperienced, overzealous, hypervigilant, and very much bigoted intelligence officers at the lower level.
When you say highest levels, saying beyond the two-star general Miller, who are you talking about?
Perhaps senior levels in the Pentagon as well as in the White House.
Like who?
I have no idea, but senior officials. It could go all the way up the chain of command to the president. I was actually told by my attorney when I retained him the day he visited me in prison, that my level was mentioned in that day's security report or intel report that the president receives on a daily basis. So clearly my case was at the highest levels in the government, at the level of the president.
Jeffrey Miller, the general, was then sent to Abu Ghraib, and they talked about him gitmoizing Abu Ghraib, bringing the dogs to Abu Ghraib. As well as a number of other atrocities that were committed there. Can you talk about your response to the latest series of pictures that have come out that SBS Australian Broadcaster has put out, Salon.com has put out?
The recent pictures that we've seen, which are even more disturbing than the original pictures we saw of Abu Ghraib, is another indication that these abuses are far greater than what we know. And I'm sure there's still a lot more material out there that we still haven't seen. This would also call into question how far the abuses went in interrogations down in Guantanamo as well. A current piece of information that we have to look at today is what we just heard about in terms of the forced feeding. As horrendous as the forced feeding was back in October, And when I was there, we've seen today the use of a new restraint chair, which is seemingly a much more abusive way to force feed prisoners. And you can look at the numbers, which were up towards 85 who were hunger striking just in December, is now already down to 4. What has caused that serious decline in the numbers of prisoners willing to go on hunger strike? It's the methods and the tactics and the violence that they're using now with these restraint chairs.
Explain them, how it works.
From what I've read on these restraint chairs, and it's confirmed that medical companies who manufacture these chairs have sent them to Guantanamo. And what this does is it straps the prisoner in, completely secured in the chair, his hands, his legs, his whole body, and has no way of resisting in any way the tube going into his nose in the aspect of being force-fed.
Your response to the Bush administration saying that the release of the photographs of abuse, in this case at Abu Ghraib, will just incite people and endanger U.S. military, your U.S. military, U.S. military around the world?
Whether or not that's going to occur is yet to be seen. But clearly, I think it's incumbent upon us to and our media to make the public aware, to make the world aware of the truth of the matter. I think that's the idea of news agencies, to report the truth, and this certainly is the truth.
Chaplain Yee, I want to thank you for being with us. Chaplain James Yee, former military chaplain, falsely accused of espionage by the U.S. military. His book is called For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to go to our website, there's transcript of the show. We are also video and audio podcasting there at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shufa Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Yoruba Press, Yoruba Richin, Elizabeth Press. Sharif Odokadoos is also our engineer today. Uri Galad, Angela Alston, special thanks. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.